All right, good morning, and thank you for giving me the opportunity here. So I'm going to talk today about bacteria binding mechanisms to soil minerals using IR spectroscopy. And so this is actually kind of picking up where I left off on my PhD work in a paper published in 2006. And it's good because John Trover, my PhD advisor, is here, so he must be thinking, gee, this guy hasn't done anything else since he left. But well, that might be true. I hope not, though. I also wanted to make a change to my title. And it's not really implications of phosphorus availability. It's more like something about phosphorus. And we find that the phosphorus is important. And so that's what I want you to kind of think about as we go through the talk today, is that the punchline is it's phosphorus. And so when we think about bacterium biomolecule adhesion to mineral surfaces, it can be important for a lot of different areas and disciplines. And so we're soil scientists, we think about it in that sort of lens, but we can think about this for other areas, including medicine, how bacteria bind to implants in the body or on your teeth. You hopefully brushed your biofilms away this morning. But it also is relevant for origin of life, but for us, things like element cycling and contaminant transport are very important. And here's a picture that I just love, this image of Shionella on hematite, and this is from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. So we can see these bacteria are just on the surface here. And so what is the sort of mechanism that they're attaching to this surface? And so this was the question we're sort of going after, so that we can start to control adhesion in different environments for bioremediation or whatever it might be. And we know that the extrapolymeric substances are very important, so the extracellular polymeric substances. And this is the slime layer that encapsulates the bacteria. It is either bound, it can be released to the solution, as cells lyse, they also release chemicals. And it's a very heterogeneous mixture, so there's polysaccharides, proteins, different enzymes, nucleic acids, phospholipids, lipopolysaccharides, all these things are just being released out. And we can see some other images here of bacteria on surfaces, and you can clearly see the EPS being put out and used as some sort of anchoring device and providing the initiation for some biofilm structure that can come along later. The experiments that I'm presenting today are all ATR, FTIR, so infrared spectroscopy. And the technique is essentially to do experiments with an uncoated crystal to represent a solution phase of a chemical or bacteria suspension, and then to do experiments where we coat the crystal with a mineral to change the surface chemistry and probe how those same chemicals or bacteria would bind to an iron oxide or some other mineral of interest. Experiments were done at pH 7 in a sodium chloride background, 10 millimolar. And so this is not my work. This has come from Anselmo Moyki's work, who did this work in Trover Lab in 2004, where he reacted EPS extracted from some bacteria with goethite. And what he did see, we can focus in the circled areas here, is that the carboxyl groups were not really that important for adhesion of the EPS. There was not those peaks remained, and we didn't get a shift to a peak that would represent a carboxyl iron bond. But what was very important was particularly this band here. We're just going to focus here at 1037, which represented an iron phosphate bond. And Jim Kubicki was an author on this paper, did the quantum chemical modeling, and sort of he helped confirm the assignment. And it was suggested in some other papers in the past that this band could be an iron phosphate band. And with those his work, he could confirm that that's what it was. And they proposed that potentially it was actually the phosphodiester bonds on nucleic acids that were responsible for that peak. And so I actually did some work with live cells, live bacteria, looking at the adhesion to that. I revisited and did some of those with different bacteria and some of the same ones, because I thought I could improve upon the spectra and help clarify some of the stuff that I had done before and sort of refine a little bit of that work. And so what we have here is the Pseudomonas species and some E. coli down here just on the zinc selenide. So this represents the unbound fraction. We have carboxyl groups here and phosphate groups over here. When we react these same bacteria with hematite, we see that I guess I should say that we notice there's not really much difference between these bacteria, and so we're looking at similarities also between bacteria on the different surfaces. As we go over here to hematite, we get a decrease in the 1240 peak, and we get a big increase in 1040. So we see this iron phosphate bond forming, which was similar to the case of the EPS. For the carboxyl group here, that peak is still present throughout, but we get this new band coming in, particularly for the E. coli, at around 1315. And so this is actually an iron carboxyl bond, interspheric coordination. And so although the carboxyl group might not be producing as big a peak, and sort of the Pseudomonas in some cases, it really might not be there, but it is there for the E. coli species or strains. And so we know that both of those seem to be important. And when we look at the same thing on goethite, we see the same results. In fact, the peak is actually much more defined here for the interspheric coordination of iron to the phosphate groups. And so that's with E. coli and Pseudomonas. And similar spectra were obtained for Bacillus subtilis and Chionella onidensis on hematite. So now this is great. I wanted to do a few things, and one of them was to see if these same types of reactions would be observed for bacteria binding to real soils, right? And so it is important to check with that at some point. So I chose a soil which would be high in iron oxide. So I chose an oxisol from Ione, California, which is here, and you are right here, so for reference. And this is really interesting. This area has this very large, extensive kaolinite deposit, so it's a very kind of cool area to check out and drive through. You can see this big bluff here with kaolinite overlaid by iron, so a lot of plinthite and ironstone there. And this is my daughter who really liked the kaolinite soil, and she wanted to play all day, and she wouldn't touch the oxisol, the iron one. It was too messy, I guess. So. So here's the results for doing these same studies with the clay and silt fraction. Removed out the sand fraction because that was just, the SI bands from quartz are just way too strong to do anything with. So this is just looking at the clay and silt fraction. And when we look at the difference here, we have the Pseudomonas putrida, and this is the same three spectra you've already seen. We jump down to this ion oxisol here. We see that really in this region here, it's basically the same as to the goethite and the hematite. And so what it tells us is that it might be forming through a similar mechanism, but it doesn't confirm it. And then the big problem is when we go down to this region here where we're looking for that iron phosphate bond, that we see a difference in here, but the problem is when we look at where kaolinite would occur in here. So I can bring in, these are the mineral coatings, the mineral coating for hematite, so no problem doing the subtraction. For goethite, really no problem doing a subtraction. But when we put the mineral coating for this oxisol, we see it has this blue band here, which matches the spectra for pure kaolinite perfectly. So this soil is very rich in kaolinite in addition to goethite and hematite. And so we don't have confidence in our ability to subtract here, and if that little tiny peak is real or not is basically impossible to say. And so we say that it may occur through a similar mechanism, and I need to figure out some other tool, some other technique that would allow me to probe this using a real soil, because real soils have layer silicates. So this is going to be a challenge that I'm not sure exactly how to get around it. But if we want to figure out how they're attaching, what we do need to do is figure out what that phosphate functional group is. And so I chose to kind of go with a hunt and peck approach using a lot of model compounds, because the model compounds really help us interpret our spectra of a heterogeneous mixture. And so I'm not going to go through all these today, so that's good for everybody. I chose was these compounds that have different phosphate, carboxylamine, and catecholate groups, so we could see what the spectra looked like when we're specifically looking how one or two different functional groups would react with those surfaces, and then to make the comparisons to those bacteria. It's also important just to understand how these compounds bind to surfaces for a lot of a lot of different applications, and not just for bacterial adhesion. So there's value in studying these compounds individually anyway. And I'm just going to show you some of them. And so for the phosphorus-containing compounds, and so we have some of them here. We have a phosphodiester bond, a phosphonate, and a phosphate group. When we look at the spectra of the zinc selenide on the top and the hematite on the bottom here, we see that we get this change occurring every time in about the same location over here, which is representing that same iron phosphate bond. You know, the peaks is in a very close location. So now we're talking between 1040, 1060 wave numbers. And so it's indicating that, yeah, this is probably the case, but that it's not matching up so well. It's not convincing me that those are really the sort of the coordination of the phosphorus on those biomolecules that we're seeing in the bacterial mixture. But and we can also see here this iron binding to this catecholite group here very clearly. So I guess the question is, all right, so the phosphate group is binding, and you know, I'm pretty sure about that, but can we kind of verify we're not making a mistake and it's not some other functional group? So just to double check, to look at here, catechol and dopamine, and looking at how they react to these hematite surface, we see that these spectra, both of them shift to having strong bands at 1479 and 1256. And over here, there's no change in the spectral region here, so we can kind of go to ruling out a catechol group being responsible. And this is similar to prior published work by Upp-Richard looking at catechol on titanium oxides, and these bands here were assigned to a bidentate coordination of titanium to the catecholic group, and so we'd have the same thing here with the iron, a pretty much perfect match. Then as we shift to looking at carboxyl and amine, but primarily carboxyl groups here, I'm looking using a glutamic acid, amino acid, arginine, and benzoic acid. What we see is that these spectra actually do not change much at all going from the zinc selenide to the iron oxide surface. We see some changes where we see some broadening of the carboxyl band, so over here, and so we have some probably outer sphere coordination, and there is an increase in band intensity, so there is adsorption occurring, H bonding to the surface. So, and there's no evidence that there's interaction with the amine groups. So we're not even seeing, in the case of glutamic acid here, that peak that we had seen before for the E. coli for the carboxyl iron inner sphere coordination. So the carboxyl groups are probably binding, probably in all these mixtures, outer sphere coordination. Inner sphere is not necessarily so as favored at a pH of 7, right? It'd be more favored at lower pHs. Okay. And this has also been sort of proposed that carboxyls, in this case acetate, binding often through outer sphere coordination at these pHs. So this is where it kind of gets maybe interesting or confusing, is when I, for no real good reason, or maybe good reason, chose to use cis amino acids and tryptones to just get a biomolecular mixture of compounds. And cis amino acids, there's a mixture of amino acids, some small peptides. Tryptone is a mixture of mainly larger peptides. When we react these with the same surface, what we see is exactly the same band forming here that we saw in the spectra of the bacteria. And see, we can compare that over here. This is the Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So this is a near-perfect match. And also for the tryptone, we see a band occurring at the same place. Now, that doesn't really make any sense because there's no phosphorus groups in these compounds, right? But so I'll get to that. And when we compare, say, all right, so cis amino acids are amino acids, let's compare that to an amino acid, glutamic acid, we see that while the spectra of the aqueous phase is pretty much the same, and when we react to the surface, they're not the same. And so what we did was measure the phosphorus content of those solutions, and it's a biological extract, and it's got phosphorus impurities in it. And so 0.45% phosphorus appears to be enough to get this big band here. And same thing with tryptone. We have phosphorus, iron phosphorus forming just from this low levels of phosphorus. So sort of starting to stress the importance of this just trace levels of phosphorus being a glue that can allow lots of things to stick to these iron oxide surfaces. We all know phosphate binds strongly to iron oxides, but you know, I think it's very interesting that you don't need much to start pulling these chemicals down to the surface. And so Maybe I'll just not show that slide yet, keep you in suspense. And so if we're binding these low levels of phosphate surface, and if these proteins can bind so readily and strongly as we learned here, we started thinking, is this going to be important for other applications? And I guess it was really from thinking about this session coming up and how we could think of bigger pictures. And so that got me thinking about the availability of phosphorus. If these phosphate is being bound, how available is it? And likewise, if proteins can be bound to these surfaces, are they preserved on those surfaces, or can they be accessed? And so what we did was tried this out with a soil, in order to represent soils from areas which are typically phosphorus limited or thought to be phosphorus limited due to their very weathered nature. If we were to imagine that we wanted to study this and how an organic phosphorus source might be bioavailable, we could go ahead and start examining that on the hematite. And so we reacted both an acid phosphatase, this one is we use a wheat germ acid phosphatase, and this organic phosphorus substrate, the nitrophenylphosphate. And when you react these two together, what's good about this is that you can cleave off a phosphate, and the P and PP becomes PNP, and it's a colorimetric test, and so you can measure the efficiency of the reaction. And so when we reacted these with the surface, we see that 80% of the acid phosphatase bound to the hematite and 95% of the substrate bound. So they're two separate experiments that we do, one where we bind substrate first and one where we bind the enzyme first. And again, we see this little teeny peak, which actually matches up very well with what we've been tracking the whole time. And again, there should be no phosphorus in an acid phosphatase. But there's 0.01%. So now I'm getting actually doubtful if even 0.01% is enough, but that's the value we got on Saturday for the phosphorus content of the acid phosphatase. So we'll check that out again. But we definitely see that. But what's really important and interesting is that when we compare this result in this bar chart, so when we have them both in aqueous, we see 97% of the reaction taking place. So that's great. But when we bind the acid phosphatase first, that drops to 8% of the bound is bioavailable and active. It can come off and mineralize phosphorus. And when the substrate is bound first, the acid phosphatase is able to access some of that bound substrate and get mineralized 16% of that. And so this is maybe an important tool that we can think about for management, and maybe, you know, some of these soils getting large amounts of inorganic phosphorus is not really as good, because if those pools are more tightly bound and less accessible than organic pools, it might be good to try to build up organic pools and think about, whether in the enzymes, or if they're present, they can be preserved on these surfaces. And so you might get long-term phosphorus availability if you build up the organic phosphorus pools in the soils. So just basic summaries are that I think the key points that is that the phosphate or phosphorus groups in bacterial mixtures in the EPS play a really important role in binding these cells to iron oxide present in soils, that these probably are the same mechanisms that happen in real soils, and basically that we could maybe use this type of information to not only think about how we can reduce biofilms in industry and engineering, but also how we could sort of enhance soil fertility and nutrient availability in certain cases. So with that, I'll show you these beautiful road cuts from my own California, and take your questions.